comes from Village Soup and the Republican Journal, providing the communities of Waldo, Knox, and Hancock counties with news, information, ideas, events, goods, and services on newsstands Thursdays and on the web at waldo.villagesoup.com.
Just a few seconds before 4 o'clock, and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and streaming online at WERU.org and on our groovy new WERU app that you can find in your app store. Coming up next, we have All About Aging with Peg Cruikshank.
Hello, it's All About Aging on WERU, the voice of many voices. We're at our new time this January at 4 p.m. I'm your host, Peg Cruikshank. Welcome to our two guests today, Mary Lou Cioffi, adjunct faculty in graduate programs in public health at the University of New England, and Joe Cooper, executive director of Friends in Action, a seniors program in Ellsworth. Mary Lou is going to talk about ageism, and Joe will talk about Friends in Action. We will take calls about 10:25 or so between our guest presentations, and I will give out the phone number at that time. First, a few announcements and news items. A guest on an earlier program of All About Aging was Deb Burwell. She's planning Singles Mingle for people over 60. She also knows about online dating, but she wants to try in-person dating through Singles Mingle. Get information about this from Deb's email, deb@paddlingtherapids.com. I'll repeat that, deb@paddlingtherapids.com. A new Scandinavian study found that people with high morale who felt positive about life lived an average of 5 years longer than their pessimistic counterparts. A friend of the program in Texas sends us a Tibetan proverb. The secret to living well and longer is eat half, walk double, laugh triple, and love without measure. Nothing there about the Mediterranean diet, but that's important too. By the year 2025, America will need 33,000 geriatricians. That's the medical specialty of the diseases of late life and well-being of late life as well. Now we have 7,000 of these geriatricians in the United States, and of those, only half practice full-time. These doctors, the geriatricians, I found, are the best informed about the dangers of too many drugs for people over 65. Too many drugs can cause lots of problems, and sometimes the person's problems can be diagnosed as dementia, but once the person gets off 11, 12, 13 drugs, lowers the doses, and has a good consult with a doctor, the problem disappears. There's a new scam that's targeting the elderly these days. It's websites selling puppies. A website similar to the one you want pops up, a practice called spoofing. Don't send money to Western Union. The scammers want you to send money that way, or give out your credit card information. Help at AARP's Fraud Watch Network Helpline. Makes you think there's a significant amount of fraud to have a network helpline. Fraud Watch Network Helpline of AARP. There was a headline in the New York Times recently, in fact, January 10th. The headline said, "Everyone knows memory fails as you age, but everyone is wrong," says neurologist Daniel J. Levitin. "Memory impairments are real," he says, "but every lapse of short-term memory doesn't necessarily indicate a disorder." Quote, "In the absence of a brain disorder, even the oldest adults show little or no cognitive decline, as shown in a 2018 study, memory impairment is not inevitable. Sometimes the mainstream media lets us think that memory impairment is automatic and guaranteed after age 70 or 75. Now, let's turn to our first guest, Mary Lou, who's going to talk about ageism. How did you get interested in this subject, Mary Lou?
Well, that's a great question, Peg. I have been teaching in public health the past several years, and there's been some interesting science around the intersection of aging and public health and how society views older people impacts our health.
That's good.
So that was my entree into this fascinating area, and it's a big area. We can only, of course, touch the surface this afternoon, but I think it will be interesting for your listening audience.
All right. Let's begin with ageism.
So I thought I would just start by defining ageism and then also talk for a few minutes about what I have learned from historians and social scientists about why we are such an ageist society.
Let me interrupt, Mary Lou. I think we need you to speak louder.
Okay, I could do that. How's that? Better?
That's better. Thanks.
So then I can give the audience a few facts about the impact of ageist behavior that's directed towards us older people and also the impact of our own, you know, internalized ageist thinking. And then, of course, I'll kind of wrap up with a few words about what we can all do to facilitate change.
Sounds good.
So first of all, you know, what is it? And I think this is an interesting story about the term ageism. It was coined back in 1969, so 50 years ago, by Dr. Robert Butler, who was a physician and gerontologist in the mid-20th century. So he describes it as, this is a quote, the systematic stereotyping of and discrimination against people solely because they are old. So the story that I read was that this term came up in an interview that Dr. Butler had with then Washington Post reporter Carl Bernstein of Watergate fame. Maybe you've heard that story, Peg.
Yeah.
They were talking about, you know, community resistance to a proposed housing project down in Maryland, and Bernstein wondered if the resistance was about race. And Dr. Butler said no, he actually thought it was about ageism and not racism, that the neighborhood didn't want a lot of older people living in that housing complex. So I think, of course, it's remarkable that here we are 50 years on from the first use of that term, and a lot of people still don't really know what it means. So I have a lot of examples of ageist behavior, and I thought maybe I would just throw out a few of the very obvious ones, and perhaps some of your listeners will phone in with some of the some of their own experiences. But, you know, first, the language that we use to describe older people is really unacceptable. So we all hear things like, well, we're senile, we're slow, we hear things like grumpy old man or crazy old lady, we're over the hill. We sometimes refer to ourselves as old farts, you know, in the company of younger people. And then, of course, we use these descriptive phrases and comments that are so unflattering towards older people. We have senior moments, and we're technologically inept. We hear that we're bad drivers, and you know, we kind of lack fashion sense. And, you know, recently I keep hearing, you know, how that older people smell bad. You know, you hear that has an old person smell to it, which is particularly offensive and degrading.
Mary Lou, could you talk directly into the phone for us, please?
Yes, I can.
Are you down in Bath today?
I am in Bath.
You're Bath, yes. So you're not that far away.
No, I should be coming loud and clear.
Yes.
So those are the negative stereotypes that we often hear in society. And then, of course, there's the positive ones. If people want to say something nice to us, they often use what we in the trade, you know, call elder speak, this infantilizing terminology that, you know, a little old lady or somebody's sweet or cute, and they refer to us as dear. So, you know, these are all obvious stereotypes. And the idea here is that, you know, some of us older people are bad drivers. Maybe we're bad dressers, but not all of us. And a lot of people that are of different ages suffer from those conditions as well. So You know, my sense is that a lot of us older people, we fear aging not because we're worried about getting older. I think a lot of us appreciate our kind of accumulation of life experiences, but we worry about being mistreated by society. So, you know, this creates a real kind of psychic weight for those of us who are aging.
Could I jump in here,
sure.
Mary Lou, to a quick question? Seems to me part of the problem is that sexism and racism have a lot of people commenting on them, pointing them out. And ageism is something that very few people think about, talk about, and all the more reason to have your thoughts about it.
You know, I keep hearing that ageism is kind of the last frontier of the isms. It is the last acceptable ism in our society.
Yeah.
And I really feel that's true. I think people just don't know what it is. They don't know how to recognize it. So that's in part why I became interested in it. Of course, I'm getting older myself, so there's a personal story behind that as well.
Of course. I remember when Bush the Elder was at some White House gathering for all the presidents, and he told a mother-in-law joke. And I thought that was maybe not so offensive to mainstream America, but it seemed outrageous to me that of all the topics he could have chosen, of all the kinds of jokes he could have told, he made fun of his mother-in-law.
You know, Louise Aronson, who wrote the recent book, Elderhood, you know, she has an anecdote in there about her doing grand rounds at a hospital, and the person doing the grand rounds made a comment about how many older people come into the emergency room, and somebody quipped, well, we should move the nursing homes far away from the hospital. Like, that was the answer. And this was, Peg, this was, you know, within the past year or so. So
yes, in San Francisco, too, where you'd hope there would be somewhat more enlightened attitudes than other places, but not so.
Right. So I want to give your audience a little bit of information about the types of discrimination that
yes.
we see
yes.
in an age of society. And discrimination, you know, I see, and it is defined as unjust treatment of somebody just because they belong to a certain group. So in our case, it's older people.
Yes.
And really, there's a lot of workplace discrimination, even though age discrimination has been illegal for many years under federal and state law. It happens a lot, and older people don't always complain about it. They don't always recognize it, and they don't always complain about it. So a recent study by Urban Institute down in D.C. Found that 56% of older workers are pushed out of long-term employment. So that's problematic.
And then I'll say.
In clinical research, we see this even more, perhaps, that older people are significantly underrepresented in clinical research. And a 2015 study found that between the years of 1996 and 2002, 68% of people included in a clinical trial for cancer were young. They were between the ages of 30 and 64. And only 8% of those study participants were between the ages of 65 and 74. And this even though by 2030, the medical profession expects that 70% of all cancers will impact people over the age of 65.
That's a very good point. So the research and the actual facts on the ground are out of whack, aren't they?
And it makes it very difficult for older people to evaluate and assess their treatment decisions. You know, the science just isn't there. It's there for a younger cohort. It's not there for them. So how are they supposed to make an informed decision about their care? So this is problematic. It's getting more attention now, but, you know, it takes a long time for research to catch up with practice or for practice to catch up with research.
Is part of the problem that the medical people treating them are using elder speak or are talking to an adult child in the room as if the older person, the parent or friend, is invisible?
That is absolutely true. There's a lot of ageism in healthcare, and again, it's not always recognized. We've come to just expect that doctors and nurses and patients interact in a certain way. But, you know, what I see, I come from I'm a lawyer, but I come from a healthcare provider background, is that our healthcare system in this country is so structurally and procedurally complex that even for people who do not have complex health conditions, as a lot of older people do, have a hard time navigating the system. So when you add on to that the, you know, know, the challenges of an aging mind and body, and the need for social services in addition to healthcare services, it becomes a real barrier to wellness and well-being, which is problematic.
Another point, speaking of the medical profession, is the problem some of us have as being addressed as young lady, when we're clearly visibly over 60, over 70. And I think the doctor in this case was being jolly, good-natured, but he was calling my attention to my age in a context where my ailment had nothing to do with how old I was. So that, would you say that's a more subtle form of ageism? It didn't feel so subtle to me, but when you think about it, the attempt to be humorous or to cheer you up for being whatever age you are.
You know, Peg, I think that's aligned with some of the comments that we hear about, oh, you look great for your age, or you look young
yes,
for your age. Or, like,
yes.
This is like positive ageism.
Yes.
And it's because our culture is so focused on youth and beauty, we expect that we have these unrealistic expectations of older people that we're somehow going to be able to keep up with looking youthful. And then when we do, it's supposed to be great, but when we don't, we've somehow failed.
Yes, that's a heavy expectation, isn't it? And I've noticed that authors, women authors, feminist authors, have a bad habit of picking for their book cover, their book jacket cover, picture of themselves from 30 years ago. For example, when Gloria Steinem was in her 80s, the picture on the book made her look 30. Now, authors often don't have control over the book cover, so I'm not suggesting that Gloria herself was ageist, but it was a cultural pattern, I guess, of wanting to look good, and good meaning young.
And you know what, when I hear that, that's absolutely true, and it happens all the time, and we see it all the time in various settings, and it reminds me to say that, you know, that our social scientists have identified some of the attributes that are most often associated with older people, and, you know, one of them is illness. And the association between being ill and being old is, it brings up the terror management theory, which social scientists identified maybe 30 years ago. And the theory proposes that we humans are uniquely afraid of dying. We are conscious of our mortality. And that results in our tendency to reject anything that reminds us of our own mortality. So that includes older people. So there are some theorists who think that ageism is a kind of a byproduct of our death anxiety. So when publishers or marketing people want to attract an audience, so they want to attract customers, they're surely going to look for the most attractive, youthful-looking person, because otherwise they run the risk that the consuming public will reject, you know, out of hand. And it's all very subconscious, right? Like, this is the issue with implicit ageism. Our attitudes about aging and older people are often very subconscious, but they still dictate our behavior. They still impact our behavior. So I feel like awareness is really the
yes,
only way
awareness
to counteract, to address ageist behavior.
How about internalized ageism, Mary Lou? It's certainly been implied in much of what you've said already, but women who say, oh, I don't go to the senior center, little old ladies go there, and the speaker might be 80 herself. But it's really a kind of shaming of the self, I suppose.
Well, you know, Peg, so first let me address your internalized ageism, because there are studies out there that say when we internalize negative associations of aging, that we actually have ill health. Or we perform more poorly on certain functional tests. So that body of research is out there. Like, we shouldn't be internalizing negative stereotypes of aging, because it has a true impact on our health.
That was the Becca Levi research from Yale. Is that what you're referring to?
She's one of the lead scientists in that area.
So negative messages, they don't walk as well.
Right.
The positive messages, then they bounce right along.
Right. I mean, she did additional research, more recent research, that shows that when older people are primed with positive subliminal messages and images about aging, then they perform better. So on tasks like walking and balance. So there's hope for us.
I guess there is.
But there's a heavy lift to change our ageist society. You know, we have a lot of work to do.
It's a shame that the book that talks about brain development and age is not better known. Gene Cohen's book, he was at the National Institute of Aging and discovered that the two sides of the brain work better when together when we're older. And there's some other positives as well. But it would take some effort, I guess, to popularize that idea through the school system, since it'd be a heavy lift, I think, to do that. Nevertheless, it's worth doing, isn't it? Popularizing the idea that age could have brain benefits as well as hazards.
And I think our message has to be, we need to look at the reality of aging. We need to transcend the stereotype, and we need to look at what really is. We need to take the science and promote it in ways that actually help people and change the way that the public thinks about aging. You know, the Frameworks Institute down in Washington, D.C. has done work on reframing aging. They're trying to come up with tools that organizations and communities can use to really get people thinking differently, talking differently about aging, using fundamentally different language to talk about older people and aging, which then will change our thinking about aging, which in turn will change the public discourse around aging, which it is hoped will eventually change public policy around aging. So that's the hoped-for trajectory.
Mary Lou, I'd like to get your response to something I found the other day called Shredding Our Ageism. It's from the Positive Aging newsletter, and the authors say, one of the problems with ageism is that we grew up embracing ageist ideas and terms. We perhaps escaped racist and sexist sexism as we grew up, but we probably, they say, laughed at elderly ways, made jokes, saying, oh, I never wish to grow old. We and ageism were one. And they add, in spite of these repugnant stereotypes, we are not likely to have escaped their clutches. For example, they say, some commonly held beliefs about older people have to do with what's proper behavior for them. How should they behave? Well, they shouldn't be sexy. They shouldn't take risks. They shouldn't be flamboyant or actively romping around. They should be more quiet and quiescent. Sounds like a recipe for a monastic life, but what do you think about that idea of shredding our ageism and the idea that we grew up with these noxious stereotypes?
Well, we certainly grew up with these noxious stereotypes, that's for sure. And I want your listeners to know that, you know, we have had ageist behavior and thinking for 500 years. When I was doing some digging around, I found that the first depiction of a witch as an old, ugly woman with warts and a big nose was in a painting by the Dutch artist Peter Bruegel in the mid-1500s. So that was the result, of course, of this all the turmoil in the Middle Ages when healers, mostly older women, were just caught in the crossfire, right, of the patriarchal church and the European monarchs and emperors who wanted to rule Europe. So many older women, mostly the healers of the communities, were accused of heresy and witchcraft. And, you know, it's estimated that like 80,000 women or people were burned at the stake or drowned because they were accused of being a witch. So ageism goes back a very long way. We're not going to change this overnight. We have to understand where it comes from. We have to understand what it looks like in modern society. And then we have to, like, fundamentally change the way we think about it and talk about it. And we have to spread that idea. We can't just wait for somebody else to do it.
That reminds me, too, that speaking of history, ancient history, I remember in Greek plays, there are nasty stereotypes of older people as drunk, as being hypersexual, and then becoming objects of fun for their wish to have a sexual expression.
Well, and that's in line with how entrenched this whole idea is about older people. And I think it does lend some credence to the terror management theory that you know, just as a human being, we have a tendency to reject something that reminds us of our own mortality. But those social scientists that study terror management, they also say, you know, we need to be aware of our thinking and feeling about this. There's only one way to transcend extreme anxiety, and that's to bring it to awareness and try to process it in a healthy way. So society has a lot of work to do, but there's some good news. I do think that baby boomers, because, one, where there's so many of us, and two, because we act differently than older people of the past. We're going to live longer, most likely. We're going to remain well and active well into late life. So we're already changing the look and the face of being an older person. So
I think that's true. We're wearing sweatpants and same kind of sport clothes that people in their 20s wear. And when I think of my grandmother's clothes, that's a difference, a huge difference. Let's see if there's some people who want to call in and comment about ageism. The number here for call-ins at WERU is 469-0500. We've been listening to Mary Lou Cioffoli from University of New England. Did I give your affiliation? I think I did. You're a public policy expert, too, aren't you?
Well, mostly aging policy, but I'm an adjunct faculty at UNE in their public health program, their master's in public health program.
Well, we'll see if someone might have an experience of ageism that they'd like to relate. That would certainly be appropriate for our program this afternoon. Sometimes it's hard to be sure if you are discriminated against on the basis of age.
I'd be curious if any of your listeners have experienced the OK Boomer comment.
Okay, we have a call in from David in Brooklyn. Hello, David. You're on All About Aging. We lost that call. Are there some other research studies that you can think of offhand, Mary Lou, that tend to counter the ageist stereotypes we might have? We've mentioned Becca Levy from Yale. I can't think offhand of the other authors that I've studied in the past, but if you take all that material together, it would certainly help to counter the notion that, for example, that all old people are the same. So if you think all old people are slow or can't work their computers or can't drive safely anymore, that's a big problem. That's a big misconception, isn't it?
It absolutely is. In fact, what I'm reading is that people become more diverse in many aspects of their being as they get older.
Okay, we've got David from Brooklyn now. Hello, David.
Hi. I have a question. Thanks for the show. I'm interested that we not lose track of the difference that being old conveys to those of us who are in the sense of maintaining, preserving, and even developing a sense of elderhood as an aspect of aging. I'm concerned that in our rush not to be ageist, we may try to be 25-year-olds. And I think it's important for us to realize that our age, as you were saying with the brain situation, does confer certain vantage points to us. And I think they should be honored and even noticed as being different. Like, for example, it may be more elderly appropriate for a woman to wear her hair up than to wear it down. It's just a stray thought I had. But, you know, not to automatically bolt for the young look and give up the distinctiveness of being an elder.
Thank you, David.
I'm an analog holdover. I don't understand the computer world.
David, I'd like to get Mary Lou's take on your comments, if you don't mind. Let's thank you for your comments. I think they are inclined to praise the elderly. And Mary Lou, what do you think about? How can you respond to David's comments?
David, I couldn't agree with you more. And I think the anti-ageist movement is absolutely not about being young or being associated with being more youthful. It's all about reality. You know, what is the reality of being older? And there's a big spectrum, a long continuum. There are people all over the place as they get older, and they have very different characteristics. And that was my comment to Peg just as you were calling in, that as we get older, we are more diverse. So we all need to be, we should all have the freedom, the sort of cultural freedom, to express ourselves in any way that we want. There may be older people that love dressing in a youthful way, and that's fine. And the reasons they do it are their own. And then there's the rest of us who want to act and dress in a totally different way, with our hair up or our hair down. But the point is that society should not be making a judgment about us just based on what we're saying, wearing, how we look. Like, that's the essence of ageism that harms us.
Thank you, Mary Lou. It's time for our transition to our second guest today. I did want to mention, before we leave the topic of ageism, that there are a couple of good books that shed a lot of light on it. There's a book by Brandeis scholar Margaret Gillette called Agewise, Fighting the New Ageism in America. And then much more recently, a book called This Chair Rocks. It's the name of the woman's blog. Ashton Applewhite is her name. Manifesto Against Ageism. She's been in Australia recently promoting this book. I hope she's avoided the fires. But it's encouraging that people in Australia wanted to hear about ageism and how to combat it. Thanks very much, Mary Lou. If you're free to hang on for the rest of the program, that's fine. If you have to get back to work, that's fine too.
Thanks, Peg. Thank you. I'm going to hang on. Bye.
Good, good. Well, Joe, welcome to All About Aging.
Well, thank you so very much. So my name is Joe Cooper, and I'm the executive director of Friends in Action. Friends in Action is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We serve people in Hancock County primarily, although also over the borders. We're not too rigid about not helping if we get a request. We provide free services through volunteers to older people and people living with disabilities. We do that through, as I said, a number of volunteers, giving free transportation, helping with simple chores in the home and or grocery shopping, and friendly visits and phone calls, that kind of thing. And that's what we've done since 2003. So we're a nonprofit that is addressing this population. And so some of the things you've just been talking about are, of course, very apropos our kind of organization. We were founded in response to what we saw, that people were not able to remain independent, to live the lives that they had always been living, because they might not be able to drive anymore. They might be living alone and be very isolated. So we started that simple premise of volunteers helping individuals to just be able to do the things they'd always done. So I think the key there, there's two things. One is that we're very, very oriented to individuals and neighbor helping neighbor kind of an approach. That there isn't any charge for those services, that we rely on donations from the community. And it's been pretty successful. But as we went along, we also became more and more aware of how people are really sidelined by society. They might have been leaders in their community and no longer are able to get out or participate in the things that they once did. So after a number of years, we started a program just to get people together. And we called that a coffee house, and we've been doing that now for about 12 years, and we have that happening every day of the week now in various communities. We also have partnered with a number of organizations to bring more programs to people. So now, you were talking in your previous caller, I'll just tell you our mission statement.
Yes.
Because we actually participated in the, we were invited to participate in the Frameworks program because it's really trying to work with advocates for people who are getting older to do this exactly what you're, what Mary Lou was talking about.
Yeah.
And so we rewrote our mission statement. And so our mission statement originally was to offer free services to elderly and disabled residents of Hancock County so that they could live independently with dignity and a strong quality of life.
Excellent.
However, that is not our mission statement now.
Oh, you've changed it.
We reframed it.
Okay.
And what we now say is our mission is to empower older adults to thrive and to live with dignity, a strong quality of life, and so on.
That's
so you can see
statement.
The difference.
Yes.
And
yes.
it really is just the way you approach it. So we've started what was originally called a senior center. So even the word senior has its own connotations in our society.
Uh-huh.
So we try to avoid now more and more just, and it's nothing to do with being politically correct. It really has to do with our culture and how, just as your previous guest has been talking about, how much we have these perceptions that we're sometimes not even aware that we have. So we now have what we call the Friends in Action Center. It's a place where people can come. We offer a fitness program. It is for people of all different abilities. We've started a program that's actually drawing people from all over this half of the state to participate in. That's for people who are suffering from Parkinson's disease. It's a boxing program. It's a very rigorous, but it's for people who might be even in a wheelchair can participate in, but people who are still extremely fit and active can also be part of it. And it can reverse or mitigate the progressive neurological symptoms of Parkinson's. And there again, it's a population that I think what happens with people that are aging is that we are seen from the outside. That people tend to label, put simple labels on
our
people.
Appearance, you mean.
Exactly, and or the fact that we might use a walker.
Right, or a wheelchair.
Or we might have difficulty moving or speaking.
Yes.
Just that is something, particularly for people with, which is extremely widespread. We have now got almost 30 people traveling from as far away, Idaho and down east, Stockton Springs, and all over the place to come to this program because it makes such a difference in people's lives.
That's good because the one in Bangor had a limit on how far away you could live and still be part of that program. Hammond Hall, I think it was called Hammond Street. That was about 30 miles, and they had great programs.
Oh, for the senior center.
Yeah, but I was not eligible because of where I lived.
Oh, no. We're just, and we also don't even have any real age restrictions. We say it's primarily aimed for people over 50, but if you're 49 and a half, it doesn't mean you couldn't participate.
That sounds good. And by the way, your coffee hour at Dorcas Library in Prospect Harbor is one of the places that you've mentioned where
there's
outreach of Friends in Action.
That's right. I think the thing with the coffee gatherings is that it's the more local, the better. People, you know, often, especially if they have difficulty getting out, it takes a lot of energy to travel any distance. So I think the more local, having it in a local library, we have one in Blue Hill in the Congregational Church. There's one in Stonington that we have in the local community center. So it really, makes it available to people. Plus, with our program, we have a unique ability that we can provide free transportation. So I think often people start programs hoping to get people to participate, but they forget the transportation side of things.
Let's get back to transportation. You're listening to All About Aging on WERU. It's one of the public affairs programs on the station. And right now we're talking to Jo Cooper in the studio about the program that she directs, Friends in Action. And I see you've given 7,400 rides in the past year alone.
Yes, and that is something that's really, when we started, we had 8 volunteers. We probably did about 200 rides in a year. Now you can see what a difference there is. We have over 150 volunteers, but the volunteers determine when they volunteer and what they're available to do. So the transportation we provide is all dependent on whether we have a volunteer available. However, so many of our participants are really, there's not a lot of options for transportation. So it's become one of the key things. For if you don't have main care, which provides transportation to medical appointments, and mm-hmm. it's a godsend for people through of all ages.
Yes.
If you don't have that, then you can, and you have Medicare, you can really be in a tough place.
So some of the transportation would be to get people to your meals at the center?
Yes, we provide that. We have lunches twice a week. We do our fitness program. We do provide a lot of rides there, but we also, I think when we started the program, I'm the founding director, so we've been going since 2003, assumed that it would be primarily medical transportation. In fact, it's less than half. But still, that's a very essential component. We give rides to dialysis. We give rides to cancer treatments. We give rides to standard medical appointments, to other exercise programs such as the Y, or to go swimming, to physical therapy, on and on and on. So, and to go and volunteer, maybe at the local food pantry, or to come to WERU. I think we've even given a ride here.
Well, that's a wonderful service, and it makes you realize in the absence of Friends in Action, there's a lot of hurt there. There's a lot of limitation and constrictions on a life if there weren't a program like yours.
I think the thing about the transportation, while it sounds daunting, in fact, it's one individual meeting another individual, and they care enough to come and take you where you need to go. That in itself is a huge social thing.
Yes.
The fact that you get to go and talk to somebody,
yes.
you get to what you need to do, you're connected with the world. So right in the very beginning, I realized that it was one of the most important things we could be doing. Now that we're doing these other programs, I see the growth there and the numbers that you mentioned. Our program is this, the demand has, of course, part of it is that we're better known than we were when we started, but it's also the growing population, and it's increased almost 20% just in the last few months, and, you know, that's daunting.
Sure is. Have you gotten any money from the feds thanks to Susan Collins, who I think is the chair of the aging?
I've talked with Susan Collins, yeah. but we, in fact, don't really want any federal money. We're, at this point, very independent, where we have discretion over what we do, and we do not get any government funding. We do get supports from some municipalities, but not every municipality in Hancock County. We are basically relying on donors, grants. We do fundraising events, and it's sounds like it would never we have fees for our fitness program that
yes.
helps keep that
yeah.
going, but you know, you never would think it would work, and yet it really is amazing. We have in fact not got we have, you know, we struggle with our transportation to fill all the rides. However, it's not so much that we don't have enough volunteers. We could always use more volunteers. I would be very happy to talk to anyone in your audience who would be interested. And our number is 664-6016.
Say that again.
664-6016.
Friends in Action.
Yes. So that, and whether you yourself are trying to start a similar program, you know, we're always interested in helping other groups get started, but primarily volunteers are always needed. However, our biggest issue is that we're growing and trying to manage that growth with our own staffing. So we have very limited staffing. I'm the only full-time employee. Mm-hmm. So you can see that's really more the issue. It's that we are to get the funding to adequately staff and manage the program.
Ideally, what would that be?
Well, at this point, our budget is about $20,000 to $30,000 a year, and I would say probably if we were to be comfortable, it would take another 50 to really be able to do what we're doing now.
Yeah.
Which I guess you're always got to aspire to something more.
That's part of our capitalist ideology.
Well,
isn't
and
it?
I think
growth is good.
Well, possibly. I think the thing with running a nonprofit and in this particular arena is that we're very fortunate in Maine that we have so many people that want to help. They really do, in a lot of ways. And Hancock County in particular is an area that really people do look out for each other. I would never want to discount that. I think a lot of people are relying on a friend or a neighbor, and that is essential.
I think that's very true, by the way.
Yeah.
What I've observed in Hancock County, neighbors helping neighbors.
Right. I think, however, the reality of running any program is it does take money.
Yes.
And it takes people. So we've been, you know, we have a very devoted board of directors. One of my board members today told me if I was going to be on AWERU to be sure, to make sure I gave our contact information because we always can use that kind of support.
But you must feel good that you're not reliant on any federal money because the feds giveth and the feds taketh away, especially
and,
these days.
Yes, there's a lot of... there's a lot of restrictions. We actually have partnered with a number of towns, and we partner with the city of Ellsworth. We've partnered with them. We raised money to develop an outdoor adult playground or exercise equipment.
Yes.
That will be in Knowlton Park, right in the center of Ellsworth. We raised matching funds, and the city helped us to get a grant to raise the rest of it. And it was partly federal funds through that grant, which came to the city of Ellsworth. But it has taken 2.5 years to get through all the bits and pieces of red tape. And it's still, we're still hoping that
yes.
it will get done this summer.
What kind of equipment?
It will have 9 pieces, we hope, of equipment that will be like, there'll be 2 pieces that people in a wheelchair can access.
Uh-huh.
An arm cycle, a recumbent bike, sort of a ski machine,
yeah.
you know, something like an elliptical
yeah.
arm press, overhead press, a balance walk, you know, steps, and outdoors near where the playground for little children is, but where adults can do things outside and go for a walk and...
That's good.
All free.
Intergenerational.
And it's exciting to, and we've really tried from, thanks to AARP and the Rotary Foundation and a number of other groups, matching funds and a couple of volunteer committee. And over 100 letters of support from the community to build this. It's an example, though, to me, of how people coming together can accomplish a lot, and the government's bits and pieces of yeah. red tape have made it a very slow project.
Well, that's honest, certainly.
So I think for a program like ours, we like to be able to respond to individual need, And that can vary what people need.
Of course. Did it surprise you, Joe, that over these 17 years, the group, the program would have become so large?
It really has. I actually never had any idea that there was as much need as there's now proving to be.
Yes.
Yeah, we're supporting over 600 people. We have nearly the same number coming into our fitness center, and we're a very small organization. So,
is Ellsworth an age-friendly city?
We are, thanks to Friends in Action.
Friends in Action, very good.
We partly with the city partnering to offer the center. We were the second community to be named age-friendly in Maine.
Congratulations.
And we still have our paperwork to complete, because there are a lot of steps in the plan that you have to have a written plan that we're working with the city to complete.
Well, more sidewalks certainly would be. I would vote for those in
being able to,
Ellsworth.
I wanted to just mention, I know you've probably got time here, but
go ahead. We've got time.
With your what Mary Lou mentioned, she mentioned a book that I wanted to use it as an example of a partnership we have that's going to be happening next year. And it's the Louise Aronson book on called Elderhood.
Yes.
We're actually partnering with the Ellsworth Public Library this upcoming year to do the big read. And Louise Aronson will be our keynote speaker.
In Ellsworth?
Yes.
Oh, that's exciting.
It is exciting.
I was going to meet her in November at Women's Studies National, but I couldn't go, and turned out she was busy too. So it would be wonderful to meet her. You know, she talked at University of New England not long ago.
It's going to be a great topic. I hope it'll spark a lot of conversation.
I think it will. It better be well advertised, though. I think on our whole area here, that book Elderhood is really tops, isn't it?
And, yes, it is. And this is, we're a year out, so I mean it'll be next spring. So
next
I think
spring.
We'll get the word out.
That's good. Well, good health to Louise Aronson.
Yes,
being around a year from now, she's only in her 50s, so I think that's a pretty good bet. But what I liked about that book was the combination of her own experience home visiting people who were elderly, older adults, and her critique of the medical system, which was very, very hard-hitting, and she really knew from the inside how bad things are. But also, she was very positive about the possibilities for older people if they get into the right, get the right person to help them and evaluate what's going on and steer them in the direction of growth and building programs. So you have physical...
We have a fitness program that runs the gamut from... we have a fitness room with different pieces of equipment, but also yoga, tai chi, and all kinds of strength and balance. Balance is really a key thing for all of us. I think, too, just being active in any way that you're comfortable is really important, that and connecting with other people. That's my prescription.
That's excellent. I've used that exercise room, by the way, not recently, but it's got good equipment.
Well, and it's really aimed for being, you know, user friendly.
Yes, all levels of abilities. And we know with the diversity of the aging population, some people are going to be in excellent shape and some not so good, and some being rehabilitated to get back to their former levels of fitness.
I think, too, what's impressive to me is that people of all, you know, whether they're coming in with their walker or they're, you know, they come running in, people are committed to staying active, and they come to do their workout, whatever it is, whether it's a class or a session. We now have a workout of the week, so people can come and follow a program at any time that fits for them. So it's amazing and impressive to me to see how people really do commit to this, and it's really all different kinds of people.
You know, we know more about social isolation now. Len Kay at the University of Maine Center on Aging has done some research with other scholars on social isolation. It's a more serious health problem than I would have expected. And given our geography here and the fact that we are the oldest state and the fact that women outlive men in general, that means there's a potential for a lot of social isolation. And I think a program like yours is ideally suited to confronting that problem in a myriad ways.
Thank you.
Anything else about Friends in Action?
Oh, there's a lot.
There's a lot. Well, we've got a few minutes left.
You have to come and see us sometime if you are in the Ellsworth area. And don't forget that phone number. It's 664-6016. We have a website also.
Yes, website, www.friendsinactionellsworth.org. And I see there's an email address too. I'll give that out. Email, info@friendsinactionellsworth.org. I'm interested, too, I think, Joe, in how a nonprofit evolves in such a way that you avoid the worst traps of bureaucracy, which I think you obviously have, but there's really no model for what you've been evolving as the founding director. You've been figuring out how it should work.
I think it's like planting a garden. You adapt to your climate and the soil where you are located. You work with the partners in your own community. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone should assume that they can do it all alone.
Right.
We have been fortunate. We've partnered with faith communities. We've partnered with other nonprofits right from the beginning. We were given a model, in a sense, through our startup funding that we got from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which was for a program called Faith in Action. It partnered faith communities with volunteers to help populations that needed one-on-one support because of what they could see. This is about 35, 40 years ago, a coming healthcare crisis.
Yes.
So it's really, I would recommend that people don't try to go it alone. Really look around to others, other experts. We're all in this together.
That fits in quite nicely with what Janet Mills said last week when she was describing her first year in office, and she stressed collaboration.
Yes.
She said this wouldn't have happened if we hadn't collaborated. And I think that that's a success of her leadership, aside from the individual accomplishments of Janet Mills, but to elaborate the idea, to validate the idea of cooperation. We've been listening to Joe Cooper on WERU All About Aging. Thanks to our engineer, Amy Brown. Stay tuned for the Ralph Nader program. Ralph Nader Radio is next on WERU. Remember, we have a new time, 4 in the afternoon, and in February, the topic will be death with dignity, and we've invited people who are on both sides of that issue. Weren't enough signatures to get it on the ballot to oppose it, referendum, but it's a new Maine law. The sponsor was Patricia Hymanson, a legislator from York.